Welcome to the Charles and Ellen podcast. We are a French-Swedish artist couple who use this podcast to share the ins and outs of creative entrepreneurship and artistry, what it's really like. And for you who've been waiting for my book, When Will You Get a Real Job? I've got some good news. It's up and live and ready to be read on charlesandellenacademy.com. Just go there and read it right now. If you enjoy our podcast, I think you will love this book, actually. I dare to say that now, starting to get some testimonials in. Today, we have episode 65, and we are treating you with an interview with Fanny Sidenius, another Swedish girl from Creatorholic on Instagram. And we talk about the importance of integrity, authenticity, and to just genuinely share what you love. And that's really how everything started for her, just sharing her passion project and what made her feel good, which generated to her big break to write a book. And it has sold a ton of copies. And just how salesy, just the word salesy is a bit itchy and maybe even an outdated marketing strategy, actually. But we still need to sell to be able to continue to excel in our art. Let's get into the episode right away. I am right now here with Fanny Sidenius from @Creatorholic on Instagram, and I'm super thrilled, not only by the fact that she's Swedish, which is just awesome, but also that we are talking macrame today, and we're talking just growing a presence online. And the fact, actually, Fanny, you've got a book that has sold over 60,000 copies. It's just incredible. So that's just a little hint, but I'm going to leave the mic. I wish I could just physically hand it to you, but I'll move it over to you. Just introduce yourself a little bit. Who are you, and what's your story?
I started my Instagram account, Creatorholic, back in 2014. And at that time, I was studying international relations. I was doing my master's, and I was super stressed because while I was doing my master's, I was also searching for internships. And I started Creatorholic as a sort of balance in my life, because I needed to come home after studying and working and just have a creative outlet to manage the stress, basically. And I hadn't even heard about macrame at that point. I was just setting up this account as a hobby where I could show off all kinds of different creative projects that I was working on, because my whole life I've been a creative person, and I have been drawing, painting, sewing my own clothes, knitting, crocheting, everything, and just exploring new crafts. It's my passion, basically. And then I got an internship in 2015 at the Swedish National Committee for UN Women. I sort of dropped my master's thesis then, and just put it away for now. And I started working for UN Women in Sweden. And as I was doing that, this Instagram account started to grow. I also found macrame at some point in the late 2014, and that was when it just took off from there. And it was macrame at that point, at least in Sweden and in a large part of Europe, it was very unheard of. It was starting to become really popular in the US, but here it was unknown. So I got a lot of attention because I was so early on, and I started getting questions. Oh, do you sell this? Oh, where do you get your material? Oh, can you teach me how to do this? And because I got so much questions, I started thinking, well, maybe I should set up like a web shop or something. And then you have to think about, oh, is this going to be a hobby, or should I actually set up a business, register a business? And I decided to do that in 2015. And everything just kept growing from there. And yeah, it was so cool. So I was working full time. And then I came home and worked some more, and I was the least stressed I have ever been in my whole life. And it felt amazing.
One thing that I just love about this story is that I recognize myself so much just starting out in this international relations, politics kind of thing. Because I started my embroidery journey really when I was studying politics, philosophy, economics in the same kind of, okay, how to deal with all of this.
Yeah.
And the evolution and as you're explaining, it's really been so organic, and it really came from your heart what you're creating. And I think or at least I'm imagining that's what people also resonated with a lot. But I'm wondering, at the time, because you say it was starting to be popular in the US, but not so much in Sweden. Being Swedish myself, I'm also very curious this of the cultural influences and the support system around, and just like when you said, okay, I'm doing this macrame thing, what did your partner think, or your friends, family, were they telling, no, stop that, you're working for the UN, you need to continue doing that, are you crazy, or were they supportive?
So because it was happening so like little by little, and it increasingly took over my like normal job. I don't think it didn't come as a shock to anyone. And also my partner, Simon, he really saw how good I felt about it. And it gave me a new sense of confidence. And as I said, I had been really, really stressed, and I just wasn't anymore. So, well, of course, he was super supportive. And my parents, actually, they have my whole life, my parents have told me, you should pursue this creative part of yourself. You should go to a design school or whatever. And I always thought that, well, that won't work for me because I can't stick to one single craft long enough, because I jump from one to the other. When I'm done with a project, I'm like, I want to try something else now. And I didn't think I would ever find a craft that I would love that much, that I would be able to actually work with it, until I found macrame.
So you feel now that macrame, like, do you still do other crafts as well? Or is macrame your thing and you just never get tired of it?
Well, I do other crafts for sure. And that's why I'm so happy that my sort of brand isn't macrameaholic, it's creataholic. So my audience, they really know this about me. They know that occasionally I will show them a painting I'm making, or a DIY project I'm working on outside, or whatever, and they love that as well. And then macrame is my business, and usually the other parts are my hobby. But my business and my hobby has become one and the same. So, like, I use Instagram, for example, as a sort of blog, and I talk a lot about my life and everything that goes on in my life. And sometimes it happens to be the business as well, and sometimes it doesn't. And yeah, it works.
It's funny. I usually call knitting my hobby, and then embroidery is my job, because I'm exactly the same. So when I first fell into your account and I see Creataholic, I'm like, shit, why didn't I come up with that name? It's like the most brilliant name, because I think it's just, it encaptures like just so much. So from your story, it seems like the name, it just came to you, or did you spend a lot of time thinking about it? And when did you recognize that, oh, this is actually a perfect kind of branding for the purpose, or for the sake of its broad like applicability to creating?
Yeah, well, when I started up the account, I had no idea it would become a business. That wasn't on my radar at all. So it was basically just the perfect fit for me, seeing as I am sort of addicted to creativity and crafts. And yeah, that happened to become a very good thing in the end.
Oh, it's a perfect thing. Yeah. So I'm really curious about this transition. So everything was really organic, but so far we only know that you're working full time at the UN. When did the transition happen from working there, feeling great? One thing that came to my mind, also my mom always say, when you got a lot of things on your plate, you get more things done, which, you know, releases these endorphins and you feel great. And I think that's a little bit what happened to you. And then suddenly you decide to go full time. Like, could you walk us through that transition?
Yes. So, like I said, it was a slow process. I was working full time. I had the internship full time. And then during the summer there, it became a full-time job. So I got a job there, basically. And I worked full-time for like a couple of months. And then the job became a 75% position. And I was just happy about that because it meant that I could like work more with Creataholic. And at the same time, I was contacted by this publishing house in the UK, and they asked me if I would like to write a book about macrame, because there basically were no modern books about macrame. There were a bunch of books from the 70s and a lack of books about macrame, modern macrame. So they contacted me. I was contacted by a woman who found me on Instagram and saw what I did and liked what I did. And she also saw that I had a certain skill in illustrating. So she thought that, oh, this is perfect. She can write the book and also be the illustrator. And this was early 2016, and I got the question and I was like, I had already actually thought about it, like, why is there no book? It must be like basically any day now someone is gonna publish a book
and that will be you.
Yeah, and I was flattered and also a bit scared, like, well, who am I to do this? And is it even possible? And there was also the added problem that me and my partner had a trip coming up, a one-year trip around the world that was going to start September 2016, which meant we were gonna take a break from our jobs, leave our apartment, and just travel around the world for a year. And I told her that, well, this is going to happen, and I don't think I can write a book in this short amount of time that we have. So I don't think, yeah, I basically said, I'm sorry, I wish I could, but I don't think I can. But then she was like, no, I think we can do it. I still think it's possible. Let's just see how it goes, sort of. And she convinced me, and yeah, so I think by March or something, we had decided on making the book. This meant that I had to write a book and work for the Swedish National Committee for UN Women. It's a long name. I went from working 75% to then working 50%. And then when summer came, I just quit altogether and to have the summer vacation to finish the book.
And you just never looked back since then. You got this first book and you started working on it in the summer. Then you left on your trip. So what happened next? Did you market it yourself? Did they market it? What happened?
So first of all, I didn't finish the book completely. No. So it meant that a lot of it is both written and illustrated in like New Zealand, Australia, Thailand, parts of Africa, which I love. I kind of really like that about it. And then when we were in South Africa, I got an advanced copy. And then when we were in Colombia, that's when it launched. So I was away on travels when my book launched. So it was a really surreal thing. And I mean, I didn't have constant access to internet. I couldn't sort of, I had to figure out a way to promote the book while I was traveling and not like in my studio and able to do macrame all the time. but somehow it worked. And my publishers are also, they are kind of my agents. So they are really good at selling the book for me and or together with me. So, yeah.
That's fabulous. And so was it when you came back from this travel that you realized you should start working full time?
Yes. Basically, the book allowed me to take that leap because it gave me a sort of promised income. I had no idea it would be that successful, but I knew that I was going to make a little bit of money from it. I had quit my job. We came home and it was the perfect timing to take the leap and just see if it was even possible. So my partner and I said that we'll give it a year and see what happens. If it works, great. And if I love it, great. If I don't, then, well, I'll do something else.
When it just exploded, when did you realize that it was just going to continue to grow? I suppose you were receiving some royalties from it. Was that the one thing that like started giving you the basic, or how was that structure?
Kind of a funny story. yes, of course, I was given royalties, but I actually didn't take them. Because I was super scared of bookkeeping and I didn't know how to tell the Swedish tax department
how to do the accounting, basically.
Yes, exactly. When I get royalties from a company in the UK, rather than having the money and just stressing out about maybe having to pay a lot of it back or whatever, I just left it there with them and until I could figure it out.
This is a very interesting take. Like me also struggling with the accounting here in Sweden, having to learn all of the ins and outs, but actually choosing not to accept money, that's a new one.
Yes. Yeah, it's crazy. And I mean, what helped me was that I still had savings after our travels. So I wouldn't recommend this to anyone. I mean, it's just me. I have a kind of phobia when it comes to accounting. It's the two times in my life when I have had panic attacks. That has been when it's time to do all the accounting and stuff.
So you hire someone for it now?
I don't.
Oh, wow.
Now I have finally understood all the... Well, I hire someone to do the very final stuff, but I do the bookkeeping and everything myself, and I have finally learned everything. And because my business is so complex, there are so many sides to it. There's like imports, exports within the EU, outside of the EU, with companies, not companies. When I've tried to employ someone to do this for me, they've just said, well, it's too complex. It's better that you do it yourself, because since you're still such a small business and it's so complex, we would have to charge so much for it. It's not going to be worth it to you.
Wow, so, because I'm considering that's like the first hire I want to do is an accountant. But yeah. We have the same issue of also it being digital products, because you also have physical products, but yeah. Digital products. And then when is it VAT? When is it not VAT? And then where is the person located? And then somebody might pay with a German card, so making it European, but then their IP address says that they're in America, which it's just, yeah, yeah. It's a mess. I get it. But then, yeah. So... for our sake, at least, I don't know about you, but we're with regards to all like taxes and accounting and all of these things is sort of like the backside of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
So we're trying to focus on the front side in the sense, well, if we, yes, we need to ultimately pay more taxes when we make more money, but still more money will give more to us. Like, how have you managed to try to just concentrate on the right thing, if I can say like that, but just concentrate on actually building your business and that effort and try to not just fall into this black hole of administration and worries and will this work out, self-doubt, all of those things that we mentioned a little bit.
Yeah. So basically I have to say that I acknowledge I have a high level of privilege. Like I don't have to worry about having a certain guaranteed income every month, because me and my partner, we have an agreement that I know that some months will be better, some months will not be as great, and that is okay because we can make it work together. I think I'm not a salesy person. I'm not a salesperson. I want to do this work because I love it, not because I think I'm going to get rich someday. And I've like along the years, I've gotten so much advice, like how can you expand? How can you make it more profitable? How can you size up? And I've just said, well, that's not what I'm interested in. I want to do it this way because that's the way I love it. And I want to have a big focus on Instagram that is not like necessarily giving me an income, but one thing leads to another, but having a connection with people all over the world and just sharing what I love, and not necessarily with the idea that it's gonna sell.
First of all, it's fantastic that you have this opportunity. The only issue for us is that we're in the same boat, so we gotta back each other up. But what I'm just thinking this term of salesy, because when I first heard about marketing, like I was just freaking. I'm like, I didn't even want to open a book about marketing. It just made me scared and just freaked me out. But then I decided, okay, well, if we want to continue this, I need to start at least learning about it, and there must be another way. And everything you just said, in a way, is marketing, but in an authentic way. Because by just showing up, you share genuinely what you care about, you share genuinely what you do, you're already making people fall in love with you and wanting to purchase from you, and they see that you know you're helping them with your posts and everything. So I think a lot of these things, because the thing with the sales sales is it's a question that we receive many times, like, oh my God, how can I take this transition? And I really think that just hearing from your experience can hopefully give some encouragement to others who feel the same way, because actually one thing, like you said, it goes hand in hand. The more you share, the more you work, the more you just genuinely want to build these communities and create connections, people will feel that.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, being a non-salesy person doesn't have to mean that you're not earning anything. Like, I think what I have built over the years is a pretty strong community, a following that is dedicated, sort of, and they know me. They I feel like we know each other. Like, they know what to expect of me, and yeah, I really feel like they know me, which is important to me. I don't want to put up some version of me that isn't really me, because it would sell better.
I really think also that the future of, as it's still business related, all things, these things, like the future of business, I heard and read many places, is actually social business and community business, in the sense of just building these connections, building communities, and especially on Instagram now with all of the changes, everything that's happening all the time online, that the step forward is really to build those stronger connections and to have that community. What are some ways that you foster that community, or how, like, did you have some strategies? Sounds very technical, but ways of just strengthening it, maybe growing it?
First of all, I've been very conscious about the quality of what I put out there from the beginning. Even if I look back at what I posted back then, and I can sort of laugh about it, it worked then and it was good then. And I have always thought about like the quality of all the photos I take and the editing of the photos. And I'm doing this because I love it, because it's a creative process as well. People say that they recognize a post that comes from me because I have a certain style. This has been something that I've been very aware of. And it goes hand in hand later on when I started working on like a brand image with certain fonts and colors and everything, that everything has to be recognizable and personal. That's been something I've been sort of strategic, if you will.
So what did you do to both develop this personal style and also to educate yourself about? Because you just mentioned brand image, and I would like to just hang on there a little bit, because anyone heading over to Createaholic on Instagram or createaholic.se online will definitely see that brand image. Like you've nailed it completely. You've nailed it. It's looking fabulous.
Thanks.
So just if we talk about that a little bit more, like how did you even
know about it?
Yeah. How did you learn about it? How did you even know the terminology about brand, personal brand, brand image, all of that?
I can credit that to UN Women, definitely. Cause I had to work a lot with putting together fact sheets and texts, and I built our website. UN Women has a brand image that you have to comply with. This was something that really like resonated with me. I understood the value of it immediately, and later I applied the same thinking to my own brand. I developed my logo, for instance, when we were on our travels. And those fonts in the logo, I use those in everything. And just the idea that you use the same style in everything you do, both online and offline. So if you put together pamphlets or like all my tags and stuff for the rope and for my macrames, they all look the same and similar and recognizable and are my style.
Do you ever feel limited by that brand image? Because what if one day you feel like, no, I want to do this style, or I don't feel like doing the sort of, I dare to say, fall colors. You have these tones of or like orange, pink, yellowish. What if you feel like, oh no, today I am neon, whatever.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with changing your brand image or updating it. You can have that as a sort of marketing thing as well. Like, I'm launching a new sort of face to Createaholic, and you wouldn't do that every other week. But I also don't think that my style or changes that much from one week to another. So, yes, these are the colors that I love right now, and I think it's gonna keep being that way for a while, because it's been my style for a long time, but then who knows, in the future it can definitely look different, and there's nothing wrong with that.
So in a way, actually, the reason why you are able to be sustainable in the long term with regards to your brand image is because, again, it comes from you. It's authentic to you because you love it. So maybe someone, I'm just trying to think about someone listening who might think, oh my God, but you know, you develop this because maybe it's in the trend or something like that. What would you say to someone like that to just, I'm thinking, no, turn off all the influences and just think about what would you do if you didn't see anything? Or how could you, do you have any advice for that?
Well, I don't know if it's good advice necessarily, but when I chose my colors, for instance, I looked at my feed on Instagram and I checked what are the colors that come through the most. And I basically picked certain colors by like pinning them on photos that I've posted. The colors are not random colors that I've picked, like, oh, this looks nice and this looks nice. But instead, like, some of them are from my, I have this lemon wall in our bedroom. I painted a lemon tree in our bedroom, and It's in a lot of the photos on Instagram. It's also on my website. And I picked like the background color on the wall and the lemons and the little leaves on the lemon tree. And those are three of the colors on my in my brand image that I use in a lot of the things I put online and in my tags and everything. And then I have some like pink colors that comes from some of the rope I sell that is in a lot of my photos as well. My advice then would be like if you have a certain style in your photography, if photography is a big part of what you do, like on Instagram or Pinterest or whatever, then maybe you can choose your style based on that. Like look at what you're already posting and do your color choices resonate with that? Is it similar and is it the same style?
But you are also selling, as we mentioned before, like you're also selling physical products. You're selling the actual materials. How much of your business do you find is the actual materials, or do you have an idea of developing? I know you're doing workshops as well, such as this fall in Stockholm, you're doing workshops. Like how is the structure of your business? Like do you have digital products or is it the book or the materials? Just for someone to get an idea of how those multiple income streams could look like.
The rope and book incomes are my main, those are my main incomes. They don't allow me to do as much of the actual macrame as I sometimes would like. But then again, they also allow me to actually do it. So it's all connected in that way. I started selling the rope, or well, I had started selling the rope pretty early because there was extremely limited availability for the actual rope you need in macrame when I started out. And it became apparent to me that there was a need for more materials. And when we came back from our travels, I decided to like really invest in this part of the business because that it's a huge investment. And I don't think everybody realizes that it is such a big investment. It paid off sort of also thanks to my book because people at the same time found me through the book and then they found out that I also sell materials so they could get the book and also get the materials from me.
So someone starting out, would you recommend them to actually go for the materials? Because in the embroidery world, for example, we see quite many selling kits and stuff like that, but we've consciously chosen not to, as we were also traveling quite a lot and couldn't keep a stock at that point when we started out. So as you say, it is a big investment because you need to actually purchase the stock before you can sell it. And and how would you do it again, if I can ask that?
Yeah, of course I'd do it again. But I really don't think it's for everybody. You have to be conscious that as you start selling DIY stuff, you're also, in a way, it becomes less easy for you to sell your art because the following you have gained, they're interested in making it themselves. Yeah, so it's you have to keep that in mind. And it's something I've learned. So I definitely have transformed my business more into supplying the DIY stuff. And I plan on selling maybe digital patterns and stuff like that in the future. Keep working on my art when I have time for it. And it doesn't have to be, I must make art to sell to get an income because I have the other stuff that keeps me going. If you understand what I mean.
Oh, yes, because we do exactly the same thing. Yeah. We sell patterns and courses, and I completely understand this idea of, I usually think of the audience as being segmented into different categories where we have those who are interested in learning it, the craft or the art form themselves. You have the other side that are interested in just you, like, and how you are growing this thing, maybe the entrepreneurial side, how you're communicating, your copywriting, your just branding, the just following you for the evolution side of things. And the third category are people who love your artwork and buy finished work. So it's almost like three categories, and it's really tricky to find a way to nurture all three. As you say, I'm just thinking for your side, have you considered to maybe walk around in concept stores in Stockholm and propose your products or anything like that? I'm just thinking if it was placed somewhere where it's already people enter and they're expected to buy, like, to pay a premium price for it.
Yes, I mean, I have definitely thought about it, but it comes back to me not being this salesperson. So I would get pretty unnerved about the idea of going in somewhere and saying, hey, look at this, I've made this, it's so good, you should sell it. Because I think it's kind of a Swedish mentality where we're not...
Everything is supposed to be lagom. You're not supposed to be too much or too little. I get it. It's been like blocking me my whole life.
Yes. And I sort of have people around me who push that for me in a way. My partner is very good. He's a salesperson through and through, and he can sometimes promote me in places where he thinks, oh, this would be great, and then I can sort of pick up on that, and it makes it so much more easy for me to contact someone when they've already heard about me and said that, oh, we're interested in this.
I love that we talk about this, because I think so many listening can actually recognize themselves in you at this particular moment of just not having the confidence to walk in. Like, we actually have this conversation with Charles from time to time, where for us it's also a question of language. Like he said, if we were still living in Paris right now, he could just walk into galleries and show them his art, whereas I'm like, whoa, okay, that feels scary, but at the same time, just to show my art. But if I could easily go in somewhere or contact somebody showing his art. So in a way, the fact that you're using Simon is your partner's name, right?
Yeah.
Whoa, I did my stalking good. I think you wrote it. You mentioned him quite a bit, which I find really charming. But anyway, I think that is actually a fabulous tip. I don't know if you actually thought about it as a tip for someone, but just use your contact net, because it's always easier to sell someone else's work. When we did an exhibition a few months ago, I was selling Charles' artwork like full on. He sold out almost all of his stuff. And it was just amazing. So easy, because I think what he does is amazing. And I'm sure that Simon thinks what you do is amazing. So then it becomes easy. And I really, for me, the whole, again, this idea of having the belief in what you do and everything, it shifted when I stopped being so sort of self-focused and like, oh my God, what I did, this is not good. And instead concentrating on the other side of it, that especially, let's talk about maybe social media and on Instagram, people following, well, they already signed up saying that they like what you do. So in a way, by actually sharing and openly talk about it, is just, you're bringing value to the table. And to just shift that mindset, for me at least, has been tremendously helpful. I don't know if you ever think about those things, or if it's still like a mountain to climb.
Well, I have to work on my self-confidence all the time when it comes to like valuing what I do. And I think you're right. It's so much easier to sell someone else's work and talk about them passionately than it is to talk about your own work. It's really tough for me. But it's something to work on for sure. And hopefully at some point it will become easier. But it's also, like we've talked about, it's not so easy in Sweden. Well, at least that's my, I haven't really anything to compare to, but I really wouldn't know how to go about going into galleries and stuff like that and try to sell fiber art.
Yeah, I don't know where the listener, like where you are located right now, but us being here in Sweden, it is an individualistic culture. We have to be clear on that. And having lived in different places, for example, Charles being from France, just comparing France and Sweden, there's a huge difference. For example, in France, just you say you're an artist, everyone like, oh wow, yeah, and just tell more, what are you doing? Whereas here in Sweden, you almost feel like, yeah, I'm an artist. Oh, how do you pay your rent? It's like,
exactly.
It becomes so straight down to pragmatic stuff, yeah. Like just, oh, but when will you get a real job? Which is the title of it. I actually published a book about it last week because I just got so literally pissed off every time someone just like, it's not like, wow, what do you do? It's more, the first question is like, oh, how do you make it work?
Yeah, I know. Yes, this is something I think everybody doing anything similar to what we do in Sweden will have to struggle with. And I heard from people moving to Sweden and like asking me, how do you do it? And
I don't know.
I don't have a good answer. My answer is don't limit yourself to Sweden. Like my online shop allows me to sell stuff all over the world. So my customers are not Swedish when it comes to the art that I sell. They're Swedish when it comes to the rope and the DIY stuff. Swedes want to make it themselves.
Yes, absolutely. I think in our soon, it's been almost 3 years since I started, or it's been almost exactly 3 years since I started Instagram, and about 2 years since we started selling our patterns. And I think we've sold 2 patterns to Swedish people in all that time.
Oh, wow,
and
yeah.
It was very fascinating to me. So for you, which are your best clients? Like which regions?
A lot are from the US, and a lot used to be from Australia, but now there are so many amazing artists within Australia that I think they purchase from people closer to them, because shipping is always a bummer. There
Absolutely.
Is no way to like come around it. And macrame is heavy and large, which means shipping is very expensive. I'd say my main obstacle always is the shipping cost, and I haven't found a good way to get around that.
Some things are like that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think just the point of, for us is also America, actually. And I think I dare to say that it's also an open-minded culture to support crafters and support artists in different ways. And it's more this that everything is possible. You know, Americans listening to this might just be laughing at you and me and that right now, but that's okay. But it's actually from a positive aspect, again, going back to internet, that thanks to internet, thanks to social media, we are able to reach audiences everywhere, that we're no longer limited by the geographical location. And I want, again, this as a push in the butt, like you can start your account, start sharing what you do, and it will grow organically. If you dare to go for it, well, that's a first step to just starting to see the feedback, actually. So for you, is Instagram the backbone of your business, or are you using other marketing platform as well?
It's silly, but it's like 100% Instagram. And I keep telling myself that, oh, I have to branch out, and I have to work on my Pinterest, and I have to work on my blog, which is super new. I just recently set up a YouTube channel, but Instagram for sure. I my worst fear is getting hacked, because it would be devastating for my business. I don't know what I would do. I just love Instagram. It's still, I mean, some people after the algorithm changes and everything, they were like, oh, it isn't fun anymore. And for sure, I struggled, but also that algorithm happened when we were out traveling. And I was so aware of my, like, I wouldn't be able to grow my followers. I wouldn't have the same interactions or the same engagement on Instagram when I was traveling, because suddenly it became sort of a travel Instagram account. So when I came back and could continue with the craft, I could increase my engagement pretty quickly, and I didn't really feel that algorithm the way people who were there the whole time did.
Something I think about with regards to this is all the time, like, don't let third-party tools use you, such as Instagram. Don't let Instagram use you, but use it for, well, if it's driving traffic to your business, or, I mean, when you just started out and you got your first book deal, it's already pretty clear just by starting to put things out there, you never know who is watching. You never know who. It's been the same for us with the requests and opportunities that we've received. It's also been people just scrolling the internet and seeing.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm imagining the next step for all of us really is to just not put all the baskets in one, because we've also concentrated on Instagram and we're in the process of branching out and starting to figure out. But I still dare to say that Instagram is not going to go away tomorrow. We're still seeing quite some time left, and it's never too late to get started in a way. If you can, why push something for tomorrow if you can do it today? And it's all about, especially when you start from what you love, then just share that. You will find people like you. People are going to resonate.
Yeah, exactly. Focusing on what you love, you will find the right people for you who also love what you do.
Thank you so much, Fanny, for this talk. Just as we round up, I would love to just, the last question, also you will have to tell everybody where they can find you, but before that, just what are some words or sentences even that you would say to someone who is listening, just maybe they haven't got started yet, or they've just started and thinking just like, is it going to work? Not like what, just how, what would you advise someone who also want to turn their passion into their living?
Well, I'm not saying this will work for everyone, but for me, what really was working was this whole decreasing my regular work slowly and increasing my business side by side slowly. So I knew I had a certain income the whole time. I had the like normal job, and then I could sort of grow my business at the pace that was working for me. And I think it's that's what I tell people, like, you don't have to go one day and say, okay, I'm going to do this full time from tomorrow, starting tomorrow, and it's going to work or it's not going to work. You can also grow it slowly, little by little, and still feel safe economically and in all other ways.
Especially when you're building it as a lifestyle, because then you want to turn it ultimately in like a lifestyle business, then ultimately you're doing it because you want to be able to continue. Then it can take time. Let it take time. It's okay. Where can people find you?
On Instagram. At createaholic. So createaholic. That's where I am most of the time. And then you can find me on createaholic.se. Unfortunately, .com was taken. and you can find me on YouTube, but yeah, in many places. And I also have an upcoming book coming out in January. So it's going to be Macrame 2, which is really exciting.
Oh yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was supposed to ask you about that. That's so exciting. Is it with the same publishing company that you did the first one?
Yes. And it's like the first book was for beginners and this one is more advanced. And it's what I've been working on the last year, like a crazy person. And it's so beautiful, and I'm so happy with it, and I can't wait for people to actually see it.
So where can they pre-order?
They can pre-order on Amazon. You can search just for Fanny Sibelius and macrame and you'll find it. And yeah.
Fabulous. I will put it in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Fanny.
Thank you so much.